for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Logistical problems continue to hamper aid from reaching those left homeless by Haiti's earthquake. Secretary Gates in Pakistan urges leaders to pursue extremist groups on the Afghan border. The U.S. offers Islamabad unarmed aerial drones to get their cooperation, and Yemen toughens its visa procedures. Joining me for the international portion of our Friday News Roundup, Abdirahim Fukara of Al Jazeera Arabic, David Sanger of The New York Times, Nancy Youssef of McClatchy Newspapers. I look forward to hearing your comments. Do join us. 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. You can also join us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Good morning. Happy New Year to all of you.
Thank
Good
you.
Morning.
This has not been a great week for the people of Haiti. Is enough aid getting there fast enough, Abdirahim?
I think there's been an awful lot of it getting in. But the problem is, and it getting in from different parts of the world, by the way, the problem is actually getting it to the people. The infrastructure just does not help, which actually brings me to the what to me has been amazing about this whole situation in Haiti. I think it's only now that we're beginning to, at least in this country, in the United States, to look at the reasons why aid has been hampered and why the infrastructure in Haiti is what it is. So it's only now that we're actually beginning to delve beneath the rubble, so to speak, to look at the politics that actually led to a situation where there was so much corruption, and that impacted the building structure and the building process in Haiti, which once the earthquake struck, didn't actually stand the test of time.
Nancy Youssef.
Well, I think it's interesting this week we're starting to see a shift from recovery and rescue, and there seems to be a prevailing feeling now that to survive now, you have to at least get out of Port-au-Prince and potentially out of Haiti. You're starting to hear people say that they can't get the medical care that they need. You know, often in earthquakes, we hear about the death tolls in the first day or two, and now we're hearing about it days and potentially weeks later because people can't get the care, shelter, or even water that they need. And so we're entering a critical time period because if there's a feeling that people can't survive this, if there's a feeling that things are getting worse as the days go on, that's an increased possibility for more violence and more instability in Haiti.
And, of course, David Sanger, there's been a huge outpouring of donations from around the world. Tonight there's going to be a two-hour marathon to raise money. But is it enough, as Nancy implies, to keep this going, to really supply what Haiti needs?
You know, we're at the point right now where, as Nancy suggests, we're beyond the immediate emergency aid. And that then takes you to two different levels. The first is, what do you do about the medical care for those people who, as Nancy points out, may well die of their injuries weeks later unnecessarily? And I thought it was just interesting in following the accounts of this, the number of people who are being airlifted either off to the medical ship Hope that the U.S. has put there, or to Miami in some cases, you know. But, of course, the number of people you can airlift is a tiny fraction of the kind number of people who actually need it. And then you get to the deeper question of what the world will do about Haiti's infrastructure. And anybody who visited there before the earthquake knows that the infrastructure was in terrible shape even before this happened. On the one hand, the earthquake may create an opportunity to sort of build anew with new standards and so forth. This is going to be the place where it's going to be interesting to hear the Obama administration. Mm. They have been, I think, very strong in fast reaction, and they have actually made very public what they're doing each and every day, releasing tons of information about this. And I think that's because they wanted to portray an image of the kind of competence that the Bush administration was not able to show after Katrina. That said, President Obama has said in the context of Afghanistan that the United States is not there to act as a nation builder. And we haven't heard yet whether we are in Haiti as a nation builder. And it's something that it will be interesting to hear the administration on.
What would it take to be a nation builder for a Haiti, Abdera?
Well, I mean, first of all, it's very interesting that you get a story like this in the same way that a few weeks ago we got Yemen in the headlines every day, every day, every day, and then it started to dissipate kind of out of the headlines. And there's obviously a lot of concern that there's been a lot of media attention on Haiti over the past few days. Will that media attention be actually sustained enough to keep Haiti in the headlines in this country in a way that would percolate into the debate about whether the United States is going to be in Haiti as a nation builder? My hunch tells me, based on Iraq and Afghanistan, is that the United States will have to be a nation builder. It seems to me there's no choice. Haiti is not thousands of miles away. It's not 10,000 of miles away. It's not Iraq. It's not Afghanistan. It's right off the shore of the United States.
Nancy.
And yet there's a dance kind of going on at the Pentagon right now where they stress that the USAID is in charge of this, that they're not in charge of security, that they're on a humanitarian mission, because Haiti and the United States have a fragile relationship in terms of the United States being seen as an occupier. So it's how long do you stay there and at the same time not look like an occupier. We talk a lot about the United States staying too long. The flip side is the possibility of leaving too soon before the things are really complete. And the worst case scenario is for the United States to leave and then have to go back in because the situation's become too unstable.
And of course, at this point, we don't even have a concrete figure on how many people have been lost, how many people are injured. Really, just chaos, David.
It is, and then you're going to face this longer-term question of how many people died of the after effects of the earthquake. And this is, in some ways, more akin to trying to come up with the final numbers in Hiroshima or Nagasaki, where you had the people who were killed in the initial blast, and then for years, decades, you had people dying of after effects. And the effort here is to keep that from happening in Haiti's case, but with the spread of disease and with the difficulty of getting medical care, particularly to the outer areas beyond Port-au-Prince, that's going to be the hardest part.
Nancy, you mentioned people are starting to leave in great numbers. Where are they going? Are they going to the Dominican Republic? Are they coming here? Where are they going?
All of the above, but I think primarily trying to get out of Port-au-Prince. There's this desperate search to find medical care. And we read stories this week of Haitians in anguish and debating, do I stay and wait and see if I can get care near me, or do I suffer the pain of travel, the additional pain of travel, to find medical care in another part of my country where it wasn't as devastated by the earthquake? So there's the immediate problem of health care. And then we've now seen about 450 tent camps throughout the country, and people are now trying to find housing and rebuild their lives and find shelter in an area where they can then live and thrive afterwards and start to contribute again and be a part of the local economy. So there are two things going on. There are people looking for health care, and then there are people just trying to, now that they've survived, come up with how they're going to live in this post-earthquake Haiti.
But how much patience can they have? There are supplies being brought in, but lines miles long for just simple things like water.
That's right, and that's the challenge in all this. How long will people wait? And what happens when they have run out of patience? Will we see more violence?
Haven't they already begun doing that?
They sure have. And yet there is an effort to return things back to normal. We're starting to hear talks about opening up the banks, which will help a lot of this, even though there were concerns about people looting the banks. We're starting to hear talk about shops opening up and people being able to buy things like fruit.
If they have the money.
If they have, which leads to the importance of opening banks. $1.9 billion comes in from outside of Haiti to Haitians to support them. So that all hinges on opening the banks. So it's that balance, right, between starting to bring things back to normal and not letting things get out of hand again. It hinges on security, and it hinges on the return of some semblance of infrastructure.
And what are the Marines doing? I understand some who were scheduled to go to Afghanistan were sent instead to Haiti.
That's right. There are about 2,200 Marines. It's part of them are the Marine Reserve Unit that we keep on reserve for situations like that. The ones from Afghanistan were brought in to bring in an airport tower, because as you know, the United States is in charge now of the airport at Port-au-Prince, which is only runway, which has been a huge contributor to this problem of getting supplies in. They're returning to sort of their old style warfare, getting off of ships and coming in by sea, and we think of amphibious warfare that we used to talk about. We haven't talked about in years, and they're returning to that to come into the country and try to pass out supplies and offer some semblance of security, but always with the Haitian and the UN in the lead.
Nancy Youssef, she's Pentagon correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers. Abderrahim Fukara is Washington Bureau Chief of Al Jazeera Arabic. David Sanger, he's with the New York Times and author of The Inheritance, The World Obama Confronts and Challenges to American Power. Short break, right back. Back. We talked a great deal about Haiti in our first segment. Here's an email from Jason, who says the credibility statement of the Save the Children Fund has been they've been working in Haiti for 25 years. That alone tells me no matter how much aid is poured into Haiti, they will still be in the same condition in another 20 years. The people there have made no effort to improve their country in the last 20 years. It will always be a liability to the compassionate world. David Sanger?
Well, there are many countries that I guess you could make that argument about. The United States and the international community have been aiding many countries in Africa and Cambodia, Bangladesh,
but
other places.
But this so close to our shores makes it different.
That's true. But the only reason that makes it different is, first, we feel a historic responsibility given Haiti's unique history, its uprising against slavery and French control in the early 1800s. But secondly, because it is clearly the poorest country in our hemisphere, and so we feel a particular responsibility there. That doesn't mean that the conditions that the Haitians feel are significantly worse than conditions other places in the world where we have had sustained aid efforts. And, you know, this is in part why institutions like the World Bank were created in the aftermath of World War II. And what we've discovered is that many of the formulas we've used for the past half century haven't always worked terribly well.
Abdur-Rahim, we have an email from George in Hunt, Texas, who went on the AID website. He says roughly $1.5 billion of U.S. dollars went to Haiti between 1998 and 2007. How was it used? Obviously not spent on infrastructure. In today's accounting system, $1.7 billion doesn't seem like a great deal.
I mean, the way I look at it, I mean, as David said, you could say about Haiti what you can say about an awful lot of other countries. And it seems to me mantra to say that in those countries, as in the case of Haiti, the responsibility is shared between, you know, the people of that country, the complexity of their history, the complexity of their politics. There's always a degree of foreign interference in the politics of those countries, in the politics of Haiti. Foreign interference by the French initially, foreign interference by the United States. A lot of the critics of the role that the United States has played in Haiti in recent decades is that the United States has always supported the dictators who are more interested in lining up their pockets, and that has created the environment necessary for corruption to thrive. And that obviously leads to conditions whereby when you have an earthquake like this, there's no infrastructure. The buildings were not built, had not been built right in the first place. So there's always a combination of the domestic and the international. But as you said, Diane, I think what gives Haiti more relevance than Yemen or countries in Africa or elsewhere in the third world that have the same endemic problems is that Haiti is just 100 miles off the shore of Miami.
And I'm sure we'll be talking a great deal more about Haiti in the days to come. Nancy Youssef, Secretary of Defense Gates, stopped in Islamabad on his way home from New Delhi. What was his purpose? What was his message?
It was a dual and, some would argue, conflicting message. At one hand, he's trying to put a lot of pressure on Pakistan to do more about the Taliban within its borders. And at the same time, he was trying to be diplomatic and say we are partners and that we have a shared threat. While the Pakistanis may think it's India, we believe that the threat to both Pakistan and the United States is Islamic militancy. And so he did that in part by putting out, he wrote an editorial that appeared in the local newspaper, he appeared on local television stations, and he announced that the United States would be giving Pakistan 12 shadow UAVs, which are unarmed UAVs. We hear a lot about the Predator, this is a smaller version. But the problem was, within hours of his arrival, the Pakistani spokesman for the army said, we're not going to be doing any missions in the next 6 to 12 months. And that's a big, big problem. It was a major setback. And it made, frankly, the secretary's efforts almost ancillary, because we've called 2010 a critical year in Afghanistan, and yet their sanctuary in Pakistan faces no threat for another year. And frankly, insurgencies thrive on having a sanctuary.
David Sanger, Secretary Gates called this period of relations between the U.S. and Pakistan a trust deficit.
Well, there's been a trust deficit for a long time. During the Bush administration, there were endless numbers of missions to the Pakistanis to try to get the government, the previous government under Pervez Musharraf, from playing both sides of the war, supporting the Taliban on, you know, Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, and supporting the U.S. And its allies on Tuesdays, Thursdays, and the occasional weekend. But I was struck in this meeting by two things. First, usually the Pakistanis wait until the American officials are at least wheels up and out of the country before declaring that they are not going to go off into the territories to go hunt down al-Qaeda or the Afghan Taliban. In this case, they did it while Secretary Gates was still there. But secondly, the whole strategy that President Obama laid out in the West Point speech depends on being able to squeeze the Taliban in a pincher movement in which the American troops come down into the south part of Afghanistan, and the Pakistani troops are just over the border so that the Taliban don't have a place to escape. If you take the Pakistanis at their word, if they are not going to put those troops up on that border, then the American effort this year might as well be in abeyance, because all the Taliban have to do is retreat back over the border, which is exactly what they did during the invasion in 2001. We will be repeating the history from 9 years ago all over again.
I think that the challenge that the Obama administration has in that part of the world, in addition, obviously, to the issue of the problems of the Taliban, they have a government in Pakistan, and they have a military in Pakistan, and they each seem to have agendas that do not necessarily seem to converge. You have the military in Pakistan who feel that the civilian government is too accommodating to U.S. Pressure, and you have a military establishment that refuses to kowtow to the orders of the civilian government. That's one dimension of it. The other dimension of it is the closer the United States seems to cozy up to India, the bigger the challenge it will have with the Pakistanis. The Pakistanis are worried about the role of India in the whole region as a whole, but particularly in Afghanistan, and they feel that in some way the United States is paving the way way even wider for India to play a big role. So that's going to be a lot of negotiations, a lot of give and take. But ultimately, I think the Pakistani military will have no choice but to work with the United States.
One last comment on Pakistan, Nancy.
You know, I can't think of an insurgency that hasn't been that's been defeated with a viable sanctuary. And we're about to send 30,000 more troops into Afghanistan with the sanctuary right there. It just raises very fundamental questions about what the United States can hope to achieve. And remember, by the end of this year, by January, there'll be a reassessment of the strategy, and by July, some movement of troops. So it's a critical window that's now fundamentally been altered.
And here's an email from Michael in Michigan, who says, could the panel explain the current mission in Afghanistan? I'm very confused about why more troops have been sent there when the domestic situation, jobs, healthcare, environment, is in such shambles. What specifically makes Afghanistan such a top priority? David Sanger.
Well, during the many months that President Obama considered his strategy, this very question was being asked in the Situation Room by people like Joe Biden and many of President Obama's political advisors. In the end, they decided on what I think you could only really describe as a bank shot. And the bank shot was that if you could set back the Taliban in Afghanistan and keep Afghanistan from becoming a sanctuary again for al-Qaeda, then you had a chance to ultimately defeat al-Qaeda where they are. And they are not in Afghanistan. They are in Pakistan. And as we've learned, and we'll be discussing in a little bit, they have moved on to places like Yemen. The difficulty here is that the al-Qaeda operatives can move a whole lot faster than we can deposit 10,000, 20,000, 30,000 troops into any given place. And I think when history judges whether President Obama made the right or wrong decision, it will not judge whether or not we stabilized Afghanistan. It will judge whether or not that move actually saved Pakistan or kept up the pressure on al-Qaeda. And that is almost anyone's guess, and for the reasons we were just discussing a few moments ago about the unwillingness of the Pakistanis to go after those groups, there's a lot of reason to doubt whether the underlying logic of the Afghan strategy will hold up.
And what about support here in the United States, in the Congress, for continued long-term funding of Afghanistan? Nancy.
That's right. There's a supplemental coming up next month, an additional $33 billion to support these wars. And this current environment economically is a very tough sell. And I think this will be a challenge for the administration and for the Congress as well. How do you keep these war efforts going, particularly in Afghanistan, where the goals aren't clear and, frankly, the results aren't clear? I just got back from there, and even the troops are struggling with it because from their vantage point, they're taking more risks in that they're not using air power as much as they did in the effort to reduce civilian casualties. And yet they're not seeing the effects. The announcement came last month that the Taliban has a presence in 34 of 38 provinces. Their impact is growing, not decreasing, even as we send more troops. So to then say, and now we need an additional $33 billion, it's an increasingly tough sell.
Abderrahim.
I see the problem both in terms of the finance, but in terms of what the administration is trying to do on the ground as a combination of a huge problem. Because remember, George Bush went to Iraq and he said that he wanted to defeat al-Qaeda there. And then later on, when President Obama was elected, he said, no, that was a war of choice. The real war of necessity is back in Afghanistan, and that is the epicenter, as he called it, of international terrorism. And then the story of Yemen cropped up. And so basically you have a scenario where the target is perceived to be moving. The real problem that the Obama administration is in is that the closer, even in perception, the closer it gets sucked into the region, the stronger it is forced to cozy up to governments like the government of the Ali Abdullah Saleh of Yemen. And the closer it cozies up to a government like that, the more resentment it has in Yemen, especially among the tribes who resent the president of Yemen's positions on the various social, political, and economic problems in that part of the world. Glum, but it's a vicious circle.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And, of course, you've got efforts in Afghanistan hampered by charges of corruption there, more of Karzai's cabinet appointments rejected by his own administration. It really does raise questions about our continued presence there, David.
Well, next week's going to be an interesting week in this regard, Diane, because there'll be this conference in London that is supposed to be the conference that both puts together the kind of aid package for Karzai's government and also tries to push Karzai into new strategy. The core of that strategy is reintegration and ultimately reconciliation with some of the Taliban. And the theory is that many of the Taliban who are operating in Afghanistan aren't terribly committed ideologically. They're poor. They took the best offer that was on the table. That was from the Taliban. And if the West can help finance a better offer, you may be able to buy a good number of them off. Well, that may well work, but past efforts by President Karzai to go do this have failed to work. And I think you're going to see considerable reluctance on the part of many in the West, including the United States, to pour a lot of money into this effort if you're not entirely sure if all that money is going to go where you want it to go rather than sort of get stuck in the pipes.
And, of course, this conference in London is surely going to focus also on Yemen. Britain has already suspended direct flights into Yemen, and Yemen says they've revamped their visa procedures. What does all that mean, Nancy?
On the visas, they're saying instead of being able to pick up a visa at the airport, you'll now have to go through the embassy in an effort to show that they're being more stringent about who's allowed into their country. The Nigerian bomber who's involved in the Christmas Day bombing was allowed to come in, and he says pick up the equipment and train. There was an effort this week in Washington through several congressional hearings to get at how that was allowed to happen, and it was a real examination of Yemen and the United States' relationship with Yemen.
But what do does Britain hope to accomplish by this ban on flights?
Well, they're hoping to improve. They see it as a new threat, and they're hoping to mitigate the threat to their country. In a way, they're speaking to their lack of ability and the lack of intel that they have to determine who's a threat and who's not. So isn't the easier thing to do to just shut off those twice-a-week flights from Sana'a to London?
How effective is that going to be?
Well, I'm not sure how effective, but symbolically it's very significant because the UK, and this is an area where it's different from the United States, the UK obviously has very long historic relations with that part of the world, with Yemen. And then there's a huge Yemeni diaspora in the UK. There's also a huge Yemeni diaspora here in the United States, but the one in the UK is much more sizable. So therefore, the links are much more substantial with the UK, which works, by the way, in this particular field in concert with the United States.
Abderrahim Fukara, he is Washington Bureau Chief of Al Jazeera Arabic. When we come back, we'll open the phones, 800-433-8850.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, by the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, your source for what works in public education. Learn more at edutopia.org. By Jonathan Cutchins, recognizing NPR's coverage of educational issues across the United States. And by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. This is NPR.
I eat dinner at the kitchen table.
On the next Fresh Air, we listen back to an interview and performance with Kate and Anna McGarrigle. Songwriter and singer Kate McGarrigle died Monday at the age of 63. She was the mother of singers Rufus and Martha Wainwright. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
No more salt when the hunger stops.
Welcome back, kids. Time to open the phones first to Oklahoma City. Good morning, Kim. You're on the air.
Hi. I have a two-part question.
Sure.
Comment. My first one is the concern for the boat people that are just leaving because of the lack of, you know, care, and they're trying to escape the situation. Is there somebody in the waters out there that's helping, Coast Guard, that's helping to take care of them, take them in and feed them? My next comment, so to speak, is about the rebuilding of Haiti. I would like to see a possibility of several countries coming in, and there can be a little, like over in New Zealand, there's a French part, there's an American part, there's any country that wants to help rebuild that they'll allow. We can have like little countries within Haiti. I don't know if that's crazy, but
yeah. Okay, thanks for calling. The boat people leaving Haiti, where are they going, Nancy?
Well, we've saw this week that they've put up 100 tents at Guantanamo Bay, of all places, in case Haitians show up there, which is ironic because in the 90s, Guantanamo Bay was used to hold Haitians who were trying to flee to the United States. I think they're trying to go throughout the region. I think some are trying to come to the United States. It's been
Is the Coast Guard going to turn them back?
I don't think we're very clear on how exactly the United States is going to address that problem. This is the problem in all this, and Kim made reference to it when she talked about all these nations helping. It hasn't been well organized yet. You have so many people trying to help, and it's not clear who's in charge from the Haitian perspective. Ostensibly, it's USAID, but you have a lot of moving parts, and that's just one of them.
David.
You know, there's a great appeal to saying, let's spread the effort here, you know, and get different countries to build different things. And certainly in terms of sharing the economic burden, that makes enormous sense. But we've learned some lessons from Afghanistan and Iraq. And what we've learned is that when everyone's in charge of a rebuilding project, no one's in charge of a rebuilding project. So the Japanese will show you a fabulous bridge they built or a great highway. And, you know, the French may show you what they've done to rebuild the court system. This has certainly happened, as we've seen in South Asia. But there was nothing to tie all of this infrastructure together and very little coordinated effort for security around it. So, of course, it became quickly a target. I don't think that the lessons of those countries in recent years suggest that simply inviting everybody in to do their own thing is a strategy.
Abdelrahim.
If I may just quickly say, I think you could have 192 different countries doing the rebuilding in Haiti, but ultimately when the chips are down, it's going to be the responsibility of the two. The French, because of their historical links with Haiti, and the Americans, because of the politics of Haiti and the United States.
Do you believe the French will be willing to do a great share?
I'm not sure what the size of the share they would have to do, but we've already seen U.S. and French officials touring Port-au-Prince together, assessing the damage and assessing in what ways the United States and the French could work together.
All right. To Rochester Hills, Michigan. Good morning, Mohammed. You're on the air.
Hi, Diane. I had a comment about the Pakistan Army's announcement about not doing any more offensives in the next 12 months. And I was going to make a comment about one of the things the Prime Minister said about delayed U.S. reimbursement of about $1.6 billion under coalition support funds. And in the past few weeks, the government has also mentioned that their defense budget is way over budget because of the war and the insurgency. And if the delay, in fact, really does reflect the lack of resources.
Mohammed raises a great point. The Pakistanis are frustrated with the United States for many reasons. They feel the aid hasn't come in fast enough. That's more a function of domestic political wrangling here than anything else. They're frustrated because they feel that that these airstrikes that the United States has been a part of is killing civilians and not militants. There are a number of factors that are contributing to the Pakistani aggravation. But when you think about these things in both Pakistan and Yemen, the real challenge is the United States is battling no longer al-Qaeda, but al-Qaeda, Inc. And they are aligning, the United States finds itself aligning itself with governments who don't see that as the primary threat in their country. In Pakistan, they don't see al-Qaeda as the primary threat. In Yemen, they don't see it as a primary threat. And that's become the challenge in all this. And that's the connective thread that's linking the challenge of fighting today's al-Qaeda, which is expanded into essentially a franchise in countries that don't see it as a primary threat.
David.
You know, there's a long and not very pretty history to these payments to the Pakistani military. They began in the Bush administration right after 9/11 as Pakistan signed up for what was then called the War on Terror, and the phrase the Obama administration has tried to avoid, which itself has become politically controversial. But what happened was that the Pakistanis would send a bill in every month whether there were counterterrorism operations happening or not, because their view was that the U.S. was basically renting a good part of their military. So you will remember there were times when there were truces declared with the tribal leaders, right? And then you go over and ask at the Pentagon and say, well, the Pakistanis have publicly announced that they're withdrawing their troops to the region. So are we paying for their troops in the region? They say, yeah, bill comes in every month. And it got paid every month. Mm. So when the Obama administration came in, and after many congressional hearings on this, there was an effort to try to line up the payments with performance again. And if, in fact, the Pakistanis say that they are not going after those elements of the Taliban and al-Qaeda that we are most concerned about, but for the next 6 or 12 months, it will raise the question in Congress, why are we sending the money? And what are we getting back for that?
To Dayton, Ohio. Good morning, Lynn. You're on the air.
Hi. Earlier, one of the panelists talked about U.S. Support for dictatorship in Haiti, and I would like the panel to comment on another area in which I think the U.S. bears responsibility for some of Haiti's problems, and that's on trade policy. My understanding is that in the 80s, Haiti was self-sufficient in rice production, and then in the 90s, the U.S.-backed IMF imposed drastic drops in tariffs on rice so that it was much, much less than any of the other Caribbean nations. Yeah, which led to disaster for local rural people, and so they had to give up rice farming, and most of the rice comes from the U.S. now, which is subsidized through our agricultural subsidies, and that led to a lot of people going to the city and ending up being in the poor, among the poor people in the cities, and I just wonder, isn't that also a very important part of our legacy in Haiti?
I mean, certainly the issue of rice that the listener has pointed out now, that was symptomatic of this complicated relationship that the U.S. has with Haiti. Rice was dumped on the Haitian market at the time in ways that put Haitian markets out of business. So any kind of dialogue that goes on now between the various partners and the Haitians trying to salvage the country and bring back some semblance of stability will have to look at the economic situation of Haiti. You cannot afford to put a country like Haiti at the mercy of an institution like the IMF. The IMF, let's remember, the IMF until very recently, everybody had given up on the IMF. And then the financial crisis came along and it got bailed out. $750 billion, I think, it was given to start disbursing this money. They do not have a good legacy in that part of the world. Mm. And solving or salvaging what's left of Haiti will certainly have to take that into account.
All right. And finally, on the Haiti to Jacksonville, Florida. Good morning, Angie. You're on the air.
Hi, Diane. I want to tag along on those concerns about the IMF and other countries, and the foreign policies in other countries. The problem that we are having in helping or developing a third world countries is the fact that most of their policies are foreign decided. When a dictator wants to come to power, it's always supported by corporations that are interested in those countries. The information that countries get on those countries is most of the time biased by the corporations that are operating in there. Until our country decides to change how we operate in other countries and take into account the residents of those countries, is always going to be that way.
Thanks for calling, Angie. Nancy.
Well, I think Angie raises a lot of great points. But to me, the sort of that what she's really saying is it's a corruption problem, and how do you as a foreign country go in and help a country when you're going through this wall of corrupt leadership, and that's been a problem that's plagued Haiti as much as anything.
David, let me ask you about China and Google. We heard that Google was going to threaten to pull out of China because it was cracking down, China was cracking down on the use of free access to Google. And then Secretary Clinton came out, made a statement about freedom of speech in China. What do you make of all this?
Well, there's sort of two separate strands to this story. What led to Google's announcement was an extraordinarily sophisticated hacking effort by, it appears, some entity in China that was directed not only at Google but about 30 other countries. Probably one of the more sophisticated cyber attacks we've seen in the United States. Google then responded by making this public, which is rare. Most companies and banks that are hit don't, partly out of embarrassment, and then went on to say that Google would no longer participate in China's censorship of the internet, and they
which it had agreed to
when it went into the country in 2006. Okay, so first the White House came out in support of Google's decision not to participate in the censorship, which was understandable, but we also hadn't heard this White House criticize Google for participating in the past. The speech that Secretary Clinton gave yesterday had two elements to it. One was this general support of internet freedom, in which she said American companies shouldn't participate in censorship anyplace. Brand America should be about the free flow of information. But she also issued a warning to any country that would participate or send proxies off to conduct cyber attacks, and seemed to implicate, without quite saying, that China was behind this attack. The Chinese came back this morning and really hit back at her very hard, saying that they rejected any insinuation that they were part of this attack. And this is where the standoff is right now, because as in many cyber attacks, it's almost impossible to prove where it came from.
David Sanger, The New York Times, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Abdelrahim, you wanted to add to that.
I just wanted to say that I find it fascinating how this issue of Google and Facebook and new media have become elements of foreign policy in such a very, very strong way, whether in the case of China or in the case of Iran. Remember the pitch that the Obama administration put in, I think, for Facebook to or Twitter, I can't remember which, to continue getting news out of Iran a few months ago.
Twitter.
I think it was Twitter. But the issue of Google is interesting in the sense that there are also people saying that Google had already determined that it wasn't making enough money in China anyway. So if we're not making any money in China anyway, let's say, okay, we're against the censorship by the Chinese government and, you know, in that way kill two birds with one stone.
But isn't some information coming out of China better than none? Isn't some access to Google on the part of Chinese citizens better than none, David?
That was Google's argument going in 2006. And what we've seen happen in the past year is that the Chinese have gotten a lot more skilled at using the internet as an instrument of control. So argument number one is something's better than nothing. Argument number two is that Google becomes a cog in the wheel of Chinese authoritarianism. And both can be true at the same time.
Let's go finally to St. Louis, Missouri. Good morning, Robert. You're on the air.
Yes, I had a question for your panel on the policy in Afghanistan, and it seems to me that after the president's months of careful consideration of his policy there, he comes up with a plan that depends on coordination with Pakistan, but he obviously hasn't cleared that out, and it just suggests to me that we've got the same sort of arrogance and unilateralism that Bush was criticized for, because I guess the assumption is we'll just dictate to Pakistan, tell them you've got to do this. And I just, I'm just frustrated with this kind of level of arrogance and incompetence. And that's, does he even have the competence to be commander-in-chief? I'd like your panel to go back and discuss that some.
All right, Robert. Thanks for calling. Nancy?
Well, the challenge is you can't defeat an insurgency without eliminating its sanctuary, and the sanctuary is in Pakistan. So that's one part of the strategy. And the other is to train the Afghan army and police such that they can defend themselves against threats coming into their country. So it's sort of a dual approach. I don't know if it's arrogance, but out of necessity that Pakistan be involved in the AFPAC strategy. That said, the challenge is how do you train Afghan police and army when it's not clear who they're going to serve? You have a dysfunctional central government. There's an effort by the United States to create sort of bottom-up government. Who do they serve? who do they answer to? That's the challenge on that side. And as we've talked about earlier, there are a multitude of challenges of trying to pressure the Pakistanis to deal with what many in the Pakistani public see as an American problem, not a Pakistani one.
Let me ask you quickly, what statement would you like to see regarding foreign policy in the president's State of the Union address?
Well, I think that the president spent 2009 changing the tone of American foreign policy with some considerable success. You know, the way the world views America is quite different. 2010 has got to be about results. It's got to be about results in Afghanistan, in Iran, many other places. And so what I think everybody's going to be looking for is the how do you get from here to there.
David Sanger of the New York Times, Nancy Youssef of McClatchy Newspaper, Abdelrahim Fukara. He's with Al Jazeera Arabic. Thank you all so much. I'll be off for a few days next week. I'm going for a voice treatment today. Hope to be back with you sometime in the middle of next week. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts.